All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a look at a case from the Kansas Supreme Court.
Oh, this is a good one.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It's State of Kansas v. Yvonne Ward.
Okay.
You know, and you actually sent this one over to me, and it's about this really interesting thing that happened in the courtroom.
Interesting how?
Yeah, so like, it's about how a decision the trial judge made about, get this, about what people were wearing in the courtroom.
Okay, courtroom attire, that's pretty specific.
Yeah, and that decision, well, it was considered an error by the higher court. Like, they said, hey, judge, you shouldn't have done that. But then they didn't overturn the conviction. So it's like they acknowledged a mistake, but said it wasn't enough to change the outcome of the trial.
Okay, so we're talking about this, I guess, the idea of fair trial rights versus this idea of, like, harmless error, right? Like, when does a procedural misstep actually justify throwing out a whole case?
Exactly, and that's what we're going to try to figure out today. We're going to unpack those concepts, fair trial rights and harmless error, and see how they played out in this Yvonne Ward case.
Sounds good.
All right, so let's kind of lay out the basics of this case. So Yvonne Ward, she was convicted of a bunch of felonies, 14 to be exact.
14?
14, yeah. All related to selling cocaine.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and those charges, they included like some serious stuff, like selling drugs near a school, conspiracy, possession without a tax stamp.
Oh, so they got her on like the tax stuff too, huh?
Yep, and using a phone for drug trafficking. And all of this, it came out of these controlled buys that they were doing with a confidential informant.
Oh, so someone working with the police.
Yeah, exactly. Someone working with the police to, you know, build a case.
Okay, so that gives you a sense of the kind of operation we're talking about.
Right, and so she was found guilty at trial.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that led to this whole appeal.
Okay, so what happened at the trial?
All right, so during the trial, there's this moment, right? Two of the prosecution witnesses, they're on the stand, and they start pointing out people in the courtroom.
Pointing out people? Like in the gallery or something?
Yeah, basically. But these people, they were wearing orange jail jumpsuits.
Oh, wow. That's
yeah, and the witnesses, they said that these folks in the jumpsuits, they were actually with Ward during some of the drug deals.
Okay, so you can see where this is going. Even if these people didn't testify or anything, just the image of them in those jumpsuits.
It creates a link, right?
Exactly. Like an instant association in the minds of the jury. It's like, okay, she's connected to these other people who are obviously involved in something criminal.
Right, and that's exactly what the defense attorney argued. They immediately moved for a mistrial.
Meaning they wanted the whole thing thrown out.
Exactly. Because they said, look, having these guys in jail clothes, you know, being pointed out like that, it's just too prejudicial. It prevents the jury from being impartial, right?
Right.
They're already thinking she's guilty by association.
That's a pretty compelling argument. So what did the trial court do?
Well, they actually denied the motion for a mistrial.
Oh, wow. They let it go on.
Yeah, they did, which ultimately led to the conviction and then to this appeal that ended up before the Kansas Supreme Court.
Okay, so what were the big legal questions that the Supreme Court had to grapple with?
Well, the first one, as you might guess, is whether the trial judge messed up, you know, like legally messed up by denying that mistrial motion. So, like, did they abuse their discretion is the legal term?
Abuse of discretion, what does that really mean?
So, basically, it means that the judge made a decision that wasn't based on the law or the facts, you know? It was like an unreasonable decision.
Okay, and in this case, they're arguing that letting those people be identified in their jail clothes was so potentially unfair to Ward that it crossed the line into an abuse of discretion.
Right, exactly.
Got it. So, what else did the Supreme Court look at?
Well, another thing they had to consider was whether there was even enough evidence to convict Ward in the first place, you know, regardless of that whole jail clothes situation.
Right. That's pretty standard in appeals.
Exactly. They have to make sure that a reasonable jury could have actually found her guilty beyond a reasonable doubt based on what was presented at trial.
Okay. So was there enough evidence, I mean?
Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But there's this other thing that came up at the Supreme Court level that makes things even more complicated.
Oh, what's that?
So Ward's lawyers, they brought up a whole new argument that hadn't been raised before.
Wait, so they tried to introduce something brand new to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, basically. It was about whether the prosecution had actually proven that the school near where some of the drug sales supposedly happened, whether it was a real accredited school, you know, like part of a unified school district.
Oh, interesting, because that would affect those drug-free zone charges, right?
Exactly. It's a key part of those specific charges. But the thing is, they hadn't brought this up at the lower courts, like at the Court of Appeals or anything.
And that's a big no-no, right? I remember learning about that in law school. It's like, you can't just spring new arguments at the last minute.
Exactly. And there's a good reason for that.
What's the reason?
It's about fairness to everyone involved, you know. The trial court didn't get a chance to rule on that school accreditation issue.
Right, they didn't get to consider the evidence or anything.
Exactly. And it also prevents people from, you know, kind of holding back their best arguments until the very end, just in case they need them later.
That makes sense. So, what did the Supreme Court say about all of this?
Okay, so let's start with the whole jail attire thing. The Supreme Court actually agreed, at least partially, with Ward on this one.
They did.
Yeah, they said that the trial judge did abuse their discretion by allowing those people to be identified in their jail clothes, especially without a good reason for doing so.
So they're basically saying, hey, judges, you can't just let this kind of thing slide.
Yeah, pretty much. They made it clear that bringing anyone, whether it's the defendant, a witness, or even someone who's not involved in the case at all, bringing them before the jury in jail clothes without a good reason, it's usually going to be considered an abuse of discretion because it just has too much potential to prejudice the jury.
It makes sense. Like you said earlier, it immediately creates this negative association in people's minds, whether they realize it or not.
Right, and that goes against those core principles of our legal system, you know, the right to a fair trial and the presumption of innocence.
Exactly. You can't just have people looking guilty before they've even had a chance to defend themselves.
But here's the kicker, and this is where the idea of harmless error comes in. Even though the Supreme Court said, yeah, the judge messed up, they didn't overturn the conviction.
Wait, they acknowledged an error but still upheld the verdict? How does that work?
So that's because of this legal concept called harmless error.
So it's like saying, yeah, there was a mistake, but it didn't really matter in the end.
Basically, yeah. It comes from this Supreme Court case, Chapman v. California. Basically, it means that an appellate court, even if they find an error, they won't throw out the whole case if they're convinced that the error didn't actually affect the outcome.
Oh, so the error has to be like significant enough to have potentially change the jury's decision.
Right, exactly. And in this case, the Kansas Supreme Court, they looked at all the evidence and they said, look, even though that whole jail clothes thing was wrong, there's just so much other evidence pointing towards guilt that this one error probably didn't change the verdict.
So they're saying the evidence against her was pretty strong overall.
Yeah, they called it overwhelming evidence. They pointed to the informant's testimony, you know, the details about the drug deals, and then there were audio recordings that backed up her story.
Right, so they're saying a reasonable jury would have found her guilty anyway, even without that visual of the people in jail clothes.
Exactly. That's the logic they're using.
Got it. So what about that new argument that Ward tried to raise about the school accreditation? What happened with that?
Well, the Supreme Court, they didn't even consider it. They basically said, nope, you didn't bring this up at the lower courts, so we're not touching it.
That preservation of error thing coming into play.
Yeah, and it shows how important it is to raise all your arguments at the right time and in the right place.
Makes sense.
And, you know, there was actually a dissenting opinion in this case from Justice Rosen, and he had a slightly different take on things.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, he agreed that letting those people be identified in their jail clothes was a mistake. But he went even further.
What did he say?
He said that having those people there in those clothes, especially since they were being linked to Ward, is just inherently prejudicial.
Meaning it's automatically biased against her no matter what?
Yeah, that was his argument. He said that even if there's strong evidence against someone, that kind of visual, that association with other people in jail, it creates a subconscious bias in the jury's mind.
So he's basically saying you can't just assume that jurors can ignore that kind of thing, even if you tell them.
Right, and he's questioning whether a trial can truly be fair when you have those kinds of elements at play.
It's like he's arguing that sometimes, even if the evidence is solid the way it's presented, the atmosphere in the courtroom can still undermine someone's right to a fair trial.
Exactly, and that's a really important point to consider.
Yeah, it is. So what can we as, well, future lawyers or even just people interested in the law, what can we take away from all of this?
Well, there are a few key takeaways here. First of all, we see this concept of harmless error in action. It's not enough for a court to say, oh yeah, the trial court made a mistake. They have to decide whether that mistake was actually significant enough to have affected the outcome of the trial. It's all about balance.
Right. And like you said, the prosecution really has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error didn't make a difference in the verdict. They have to convince the higher court that it was truly harmless.
Exactly. Then there's this idea of abuse of discretion, which is, you know, it's relevant to trial judges all the time. They have a lot of power in their courtrooms, but they can't just do whatever they want. They have to follow the rules, make sure that their decisions are fair.
Right. It's a reminder that their authority has limits.
Exactly. And then, of course, we have that lesson about preservation of error, which you'll hear about all the time in law school and in practice. You have to raise your arguments at the right time and in the right court, or you might lose your chance to use them later.
It's all about dotting your I's and crossing your T's, right?
Exactly. It's crucial. And this case also raises some interesting strategic questions, especially for those of you who are thinking about going into criminal law. You know, why would the prosecution even risk having those people identified in their jail clothes? It seems like an unnecessary gamble, and it almost backfired on them.
Right. And what could the defense have done differently, you know, in terms of objecting or making a stronger case for a mistrial? There are always those strategic choices to think about.
For sure. And this whole case, it really highlights those fundamental constitutional rights that we're always talking about, the right to a fair trial and the presumption of innocence. It's not just about the evidence itself. It's about how that evidence is presented and the overall atmosphere in the courtroom. You know, the visual of those people in jail clothes, it directly relates to that idea that you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty.
And it connects to that Supreme Court case you mentioned, Estelle v. Williams, where they said forcing a defendant to wear prison clothes during trial violates their rights. It's all about avoiding any unnecessary prejudice against the accused.
Exactly. So to sum it all up, what does State of Kansas v. Yvonne Ward tell us? It shows us how appellate courts handle potential errors that happen during trials. A mistake by the trial court doesn't automatically mean a new trial. They'll carefully consider if that error really influenced the jury's decision. And it also highlights the importance of procedure in the legal system. Missing deadlines or failing to raise arguments at the right time can have huge consequences, even if you have a good point.
Right. It's a good reminder to stay organized and make sure you're following all the rules.
Absolutely. But this case leaves us with something to think about. How do we really measure the impact of something like seeing people in jail clothes, being linked to the defendant? How do we measure the impact of that on the jury? It's a complex question, and it goes beyond just applying a simple harmless error test. The dissent in this case, it really reminds us that fairness and the presumption of innocence, they're not just abstract ideas. They have real consequences in the courtroom.
So it's a reminder to be mindful of all the subtle things that can affect a jury's perception, even if it's not directly related to the evidence itself.
Exactly. And that's something for all of us to keep in mind as we move forward in our legal careers.
Food for thought, for sure.
All right. Well, that's our deep dive into Kansas v. Ward.
Thanks for breaking that down.
Thanks for joining me. And to everyone listening, we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.